I had the honor of being at the Libertarian Party Virginia convention last weekend in Richmond. And our next guest was introduced by Dr. Jim Lark, our regional representative who will be here eventually this afternoon. And in introducing Carla Powell, he said, sometimes you get lucky, and this time we did. And I totally agree. We are very fortunate to have Carla Howe as the Libertarian Party Executive Director. Carla has spearheaded, has been the spokesperson and champion of two Massachusetts ballot initiatives to get rid of the state income tax in 2002-2008. In 2002, it got 45%. This is in a state bluer than Maryland. In 2008, even though it did not succeed, the teachers' union spent $7 million just basically to break even. In 2010, she ran the effort to lower the state sales tax from 6.25% to 3%, which was the lowest you can do constitutionally. Almost got a million votes, and the teachers' union spent another $4.5 million just to break even, basically. She ran for the U.S. Senate in 2000 against Ted Kennedy and a Republican and received 12% of the vote, which is the highest vote total for any Libertarian federal candidate in a three-way race with a Democrat and Republican, missed beating the Republican by one percentage point and raised over $800,000. Probably a record for a federal Libertarian candidate that wasn't a presidential race. She ran for state auditor in 1998, governor in 2002 against someone by the name of Mitt Romney. You may have heard of him. She's been in software development for over 20 years, marketing and project management, and please welcome Carla. Oh, Carla's also my boss, so pay attention and clap really loud. There we go.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Can you hear me well in the back? Okay, great. Just let me know if you have any trouble. It was nice listening to Paul speak because when I ran against Ted Kennedy especially, guns was very much at the forefront of that campaign, and it was a nice reminder of the days parading and rallying with gun owners in Massachusetts to try to repeal the draconian gun laws up there. So good luck to you here on that front and every other front. I'm going to switch gears a little bit here and talk about government spending. What makes the U.S. Constitution so great is that it was designed to keep government small, to limit government authority. But the Constitution is failing that mission, now more than ever. In 1992, the federal government was $1.3 trillion. Today, it is $3.8 trillion. In less than 20 years, it has grown threefold. Everything that big government does that violates the Constitution owes its existence to high government spending. The lifeblood of big government is money, your money. Big government programs live and breathe on high government spending. Big government, Democrats and Republicans, rely on donations and support from special interests who want the $3.8 trillion federal gravy train to keep flowing. And they want the additional $3 trillion in state and local government funds to keep flowing. But they want you to believe the opposite, that they spend our tax dollars wisely, that they diligently cut spending at every opportunity. They pull from a bag of tricks that they use on voters and taxpayers every day to keep government spending high. As libertarians who honestly believe that government is way too big and who actually want to shrink big government, we can distinguish ourselves from our big government opponents by understanding and exposing their tricks. So what are some of the ways that they con us into allowing them to keep government spending high? They'll get us talking about every issue under the sun, except cutting government spending. They'll create controversies over areas of government that represent less than 5% of total spending, or even less than 1%. Look at what they've been talking about lately. They've gotten everyone fired up over the issue of funding of contraceptives, which represents less than 0.03% of federal spending. Or they lure us into endless partisan bashing, liberals bashing conservatives, conservatives bashing liberals. A veritable industry of political pundits makes it their job to get you hating the other side. And while they're bashing each other as politicians and ideologies and legislation, Democrats and Republicans are all voting to increase government spending, with almost no exceptions. They are all voting to sustain high government spending and keep it growing higher. Now, these days, things have gotten so bad, government spending has gotten so astronomical, that it's finally getting more press. Spending cuts are finally being talked about. So now, what do? How do they try to manipulate us so that they can avoid actually cutting high government spending? One of their favorites is to talk about government functions rather than government waste. Government spending is marbled with waste everywhere you look. It's safe to say that any government budget at any level, anywhere in this country, can be safely and immediately cut by at least 10% just by eliminating the obvious waste. More than 90% of all governments, everywhere in the country, at every level, can be safely and immediately cut by over 50% just by eliminating waste. But Democrat and Republican politicians deny that there is anything more than trivial amounts of waste within government departments and agencies and bureaucracies. They insist that the only way to cut government spending is to cut the functions of government services rather than the legions of waste within those functions. We must lay off teachers, they say, rather than stop allowing them to retire at age 54 so they don't need to hire more teachers to replace them. Or they say the post office is broke, so we have to close branches, or we have to cut Saturday delivery. But where's the discussion about waste within the postal system? Do you think there's any? Like the insanely lucrative pensions they've been doling out for years, or the labor contracts that they use as an excuse to avoid firing employees who are dead weight. Instead of eliminating waste, they threaten to make you pay with fewer services. Another perennial favorite of those who protect and preserve high government spending is what we like to call the sky is falling. How many know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
They'll threaten to cut the things that you care about most. Has anyone here had to cut their family budget or their business budget in the last 3 years? Now, how did you handle it? Did you cut the things your family or your business needs the most? Or did you cut the things that you can do without? Did you force your kids to wear shoes that don't fit anymore first? Or do you scrap your plans to install a new in-ground swimming pool first? Which one is a higher priority? If you would rather force your kids to wear shoes that hurt their feet, claiming there's no money in the new clothes budget, while installing a new swimming pool in your backyard, then you would qualify to be a U.S. congressman. Some of the tried and true favorites are police, fire, schools,
Medivac.
And roads.
Medivac.
Okay.
Medivac.
But these functions, if you look at the numbers, these functions account for a shockingly minuscule portion of total government spending. In 2010, as Bob mentioned, I headed a Massachusetts ballot initiative to roll back the sales tax from 6.25% to 3%. Our big government opponents ran millions of dollars in ads to convince voters that cutting the sales tax would absolutely require us to cut back on police and fire protection and schools. Their ads featured blaring fire trucks rushing to save burning houses. They blanketed the airwaves with thousands of those ads. Boston radio talk host Howie Carr joked that from watching these ads, he said, you'd swear there couldn't be a single building still standing in Massachusetts that hadn't burnt to the ground. But how much of the $54 billion that the Massachusetts state government politicians spend every year goes to firefighting? About $100 million, less than 0.2%. Most firefighting isn't even funded by the state government. It's paid for by local governments. Rolling back the sales tax would not affect fire protection one iota. Their ads, their prognostications were a complete sham. What are they doing when they make these wild, fictitious claims? They're blackmailing voters. Advocates for big government were attempting to blackmail voters, deliberately putting the highest priority spending items on the chopping block instead of where they belong, at the bottom of the list to cut. And all the while pretending the things that should be cut first don't exist, like special interest pork, waste, clumsy, redundant bureaucracies, unneeded big government programs, or damaging big government programs that do more harm than good. We got our hands on some of our opposition's training materials that they were handing out to their supporters. Their instructions were, avoid the subject of waste. They know it's a powerful argument, and they didn't want to talk about it. The sky is falling. Fear-mongering is perhaps the tactic used most by big government advocates to keep government spending high. If they did what was right, if they prioritized spending cuts correctly, there would be no need to cut a single service that anyone is dependent on or that hurts ordinary workers and taxpayers. That's not to say we shouldn't cut spending in just about every area of government, that we shouldn't wean people off of welfare and subsidies. We should. But we should do so in the least painful way possible, not the most painful way possible. While protecting and enriching their special interest pals, big government politicians propose spending cuts that hurt everyday taxpayers and workers who have no representation in the halls of Congress or in state capitals. They now propose higher retirement ages for Social Security and cutting Medicare and Medicaid. We will have to cut these programs. But while the politicians threaten to cut them, they're doling out increases in lucrative pensions for government workers and government contractors who are already overpaid, who are already getting benefits that dwarf those of private sector workers. They're proposing cuts in Social Security and Medicare while they're introducing new big government programs and hiring more unneeded government workers. Government largesse must be cut first. The paltry returns from Social Security and Medicare that taxpayers have been forced to pay into all of their lives should be cut last. Another ploy of those who seek to preserve and protect high government spending is future spending. They avoid cutting government spending by talking about their 10-year plans. Federal lawmakers have the audacity to claim that their proposals cut spending by trillions of dollars, but they're cutting from future planned budgets that are dramatically higher than today's spending. Imaginary budgets. The very idea that today's lawmakers can dictate tomorrow's budget is patently absurd. Think about it. Does anyone even remember what congressmen said they would be spending today, 5 years ago, or 10 years ago? Do you think those projected budgets bear any resemblance to what they're spending today? Any budget sent by today's Congress will be virtually ignored by the next Congress that takes power after this November's election in just 8 months from now. Not to mention the Congress that takes power in 2014 or 2016 or 2018 or 2020. While politicians talk of cutting spending in the future, when they talk about cutting spending in the future, it is a manipulation. It's a lie. They're merely trying to distract you from the fact that they're raising spending today. There's only one way to cut government spending, and that is to cut today's government spending, from the current budget or from the budget that is being voted on for the year that's about to begin. Politicians also like to avoid talking about total government spending. They talk about spending cuts in particular areas, hoping you won't notice that total government spending stayed the same or went up. Politicians are notorious for shifting around government spending rather than cutting it and ending up with the same level of total spending, if not substantially more. How many of you have heard of stories of government workers who got laid off and ended up in a new job down the street the following Monday? Anyone hear of those? They happen all the time. They never miss a single day of pay. Almost never does an alleged cut in government spending result in total government spending going down. Total government spending is always going up. Another ploy of big government advocates, limiting the growth of government. Many politicians, especially Republicans, want you to believe that they are fiscally conservative and financially responsible, that if they slow the growth of government or limit the growth of government, they're giving you something that you want, or if they hold the line on government spending. But let's think about how absurd this is. Federal spending is now $3.8 trillion. Federal government revenue is just $2.2 trillion. We need to cut today's federal government spending by over 40% just to balance the budget, just to stop bleeding red ink, just to stop the feds from printing more money and devaluing the dollar more. Here's another way of looking at it. You may know the actress Valerie Bertinelli. She starred in the TV show One Day at a Time and also Touched by an Angel. You may have seen her in commercials for the Jenny Craig Weight Loss Company. Valerie Bertinelli is 5 feet 2 inches tall. She was also very petite until she put on weight and tipped the scales at 172 pounds, which, of course, is a very big deal if you're a TV star. So Valerie went to Jenny Craig for help. She did not say, "I've put on 40 pounds of fat. Can you help me stay this fat and hold the line? Make sure I stay at 172. She did not say, "I've put on 40 pounds of fat. Can you help me get fatter, but at a slower rate than I put on the last 40 pounds? I want to be sure I don't hit 212 pounds for at least another 10 years. Is that what she said? This is the twisted logic behind the rhetoric that big government politicians who claim they want to hold the line or limit or slow the growth of government are using. We don't need to slow the growth of government any more than Valerie Bertinelli needs to put on another 40 pounds. We need to shrink it. A lot. Now. Just as keeping on needless and unhealthy body fat is bad and losing that fat is good, keeping government revenue high is
bad.
And less government spending is
good.
Notice how many politicians brag about bringing home the bacon, as if that's a good thing. Have they lauded legislation that brings in more needed revenue for the government? They want you to believe that more money in the coffers of big government is somehow going to help you, your family, or your community, rather than enrich special interests, place more burdens on business, deplete your wealth, and violate your rights. That's what high government spending does. And that's why we're much better off when government has less of our money. Higher government revenue is
bad.
Lower government revenue is
good.
These are just a few of the ways that politicians and the mainstream media used to black out and avoid real proposals to cut total government spending now. This is why government today is nowhere near the small constitutional government our founders fought for. Big government advocates simply avoid the issue of cutting government spending when they can get away with it and talk about other issues that are guaranteed to keep government spending high. Partisan issues that serve to bash the other side, that polarize voters around the meaningless, artificial distinction of left versus right, instead of the only distinction that matters, big government versus small government, high government spending versus low government spending. They talk about future spending rather than cutting from today's spending. They make great fanfare of the spending cuts, their bold spending cuts in a particular area of government, while increasing total government spending. They pretend that adding more revenue to obscenely high government budgets is good rather than bad. They want you to accept slowing the growth of government or holding the line on government spending as the most we can ever hope for. They threaten to cut whole functions of government rather than waste within government. And they threaten to cut the things we depend on most rather than the things we need the least. There's a reason why big government politicians and advocates dodge and avoid real proposals to cut spending, because they want to keep government spending high. But we will never have small constitutional government so long as total government spending remains high. We will never have real freedom if total government spending remains high. If we were to end the war on drugs, for example, what do you think politicians would do with $100 billion that would free up? Do you think they would give it back to taxpayers?
No.
Or would they use it to fund the next war on our freedoms? This is why substantially cutting government spending is the most immediate and pressing issue of our time, the number one political priority in America. Now, here's the good news. Why do you suppose big government politicians go to such lengths to deceive voters?
Because they can.
They pretend not. Why do they pretend not to be jacking up spending? To pretend they're not spending like drunken sailors, with my apologies to drunken sailors. Why would they do that? Do people want high government spending? Do voters want, do even Democrats want high government spending? They don't. If they did, wouldn't the politicians be bragging about it? Wouldn't Bush have said, Clinton left the federal budget at $1.9 trillion, I got it up to $3.2 trillion, yeah. And wouldn't Obama say, $3.2, I got it up to $3.8 in 3 years, yeah. But that's not what they're saying, is it? No one wants high government spending. Today, poll after poll shows that a solid majority of Americans want much less government than we have today. 50 to 65% in every poll we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years. Americans want smaller government than we have today, lower taxes, and lower government spending. More than ever, Americans want what libertarians offer. All we need to do is make them that offer. Where big government Democrats and Republicans keep budgets high and growing, libertarians can propose bold government spending cuts now. Where big government Democrats and Republicans pretend to cut government spending while voting for bigger budgets, libertarians can expose their tricks and their games and their manipulations and call for humane and sensible cuts in spending. Where big government Democrats and Republicans dole out pork and favors to special interest profiteers, libertarians can propose to drive down government spending and therefore keep taxes much lower for hardworking taxpayers and for the small businesses of America. To restore the Constitution, to end our nation's burgeoning debt crisis, to turn around big government and make it small, we must cut today's total government spending dramatically, boldly, and at all levels of government. We must think big, and we must cut big, and we must do it now. Much smaller government and much lower government spending will lead to more private sector jobs, more freedom, and more prosperity. So as libertarians, excuse me, let's never miss an opportunity to distinguish how our Democrat and Republican opponents are forcing on us exactly what Americans do not want. And let's give Americans what they do want: bold, immediate government spending cuts now. And every time we put a libertarian solution on the table, we must always spell out the benefits to voters. Bold, immediate spending cuts now means lower taxes, more money in your family budget. More money in the private sector means more jobs, more private sector jobs. And more money in your family budget means more that you can spend, save, use to pay off debts, or give away as you see fit. And less government waste means government agencies held to account for serving the public rather than serving special interest greed. These are among the many benefits of libertarian solutions that offer bold, immediate spending cuts now. So let's offer it. Thank you. Thanks. I can take questions for as long as Bob does know. So, yes, sir.
You're going to run for office again, aren't you?
Please.
Thanks. I don't have any. I'm now the executive director at the headquarters.
I understand that. So 4 years ahead. I
never rule it out. I never rule it out. Thank you.
Yeah, I just have one comment followed by a question. The first comment is that if we're going to really sell this whole idea of what you just said, we have to do the
cutting government spending.
Yeah.
Now.
Okay. I think we need to come up with the equivalent of those firefighter, you know, burning house ads. At least a few case studies, you know, where we show really egregious government waste, like you see in the Brickbats section of Reason magazine. Because just talking about cutting spending and there's waste everywhere, it gets boring. I mean, the average citizen, of which I'm typical of, like, I find it really boring. It's not something you can really get woo about. So,
well,
yeah,
that's a very good point. And you're going to be hearing me talk a lot more about what I call libertarian solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, especially if you're a candidate, but it doesn't have to be in the context of a campaign. Since we're a political party, usually it will be in the context of a campaign. We want to offer solutions for voters. Now, what I would usually recommend is that the spending cuts not be the primary focus. Tax cuts are much better primary focus. And then you say when we cut taxes, we will cut government spending by a commensurate amount, and vice versa. In fact, I think it's very important that all government spending cuts should come with cuts. And we need to identify cuts in government, but we also need to, what are you going to do with that money? You're either going to cut taxes or you're going to pay off the debt or bring the budget more in balance in the case of the federal government. So the spending cuts don't stand alone as a proposal, and I'm glad you raised this issue. But we shouldn't be afraid of them. We should go after aggressively selling why they're a benefit. Now, I've run 3 tax cut ballot initiatives because tax cuts are the easiest sell on earth. They're simple. People know what they are. You want to get rid of your income tax? Yeah. They know what it is and they like it. You want to cut the sales tax? Sure. People know what it is and they like it. Tax cuts are always a great thing to run on. Now, some people say, well, that's focusing too much on economic issues. What about social issues? Well, you can run on things like ending the war on drugs. But when you do, when you run on cutting anything, what I recommend is always translate that into dollars and call for cutting government spending. So you defund the program and you give that money back to the taxpayers or you use it to pay off debt. Tax cuts are always a better sell. So you can stick a tax cut proposal into almost any proposal that's a libertarian solution.
My question was, is there a place or a place on the planet where you can see a concrete demonstration of the idea that when you cut government spending and cut taxes and all that, that there's the prosperity, economic prosperity results?
Yes. Well, we ran these ballot initiatives, 2 to end the state income tax in Massachusetts, which is a 5.3% income tax, and 1 to cut the sales tax in half, essentially. Our websites are, our most recent one is called rollbacktaxes.com. It's archived, but it's still accessible, and you can see how we laid out our case for it and, you know, how we responded to objections, specific cuts that we recommended. We had a whole page of listing all the ways, probably similar to the Reason magazine that you mentioned, so people can see. You know, it's funny because everybody knows there's government waste. And then they hear the manipulations about your house will burn down, your kids' school teachers will disappear into thin air. They will be vaporized. but they forget about the waste. And you have to remind them. And it's funny, I remember talking to one gentleman
you know, I said, would you like to see the sales tax roll back to 3%? He said, yeah. But what about the police? And I said, you know there's waste in government, don't you? You know how much waste there is in government. You start getting them talking. You got to get them talking. This is why our opponents say, don't talk about waste. We got to get them talking. Mm-hmm. Remind them. Get them to connect the dots. And then they can go. So you see that when we cut the sales tax, which takes out 5% of total state government spending, it's not going to affect police and school and fire, which are almost entirely locally funded. And even if they were funded by the state, we're talking 5%. When that all that stuff together is something like 5 to 10% of the state budget, and there's gobs of waste in the other 80% that we could cut. Oh, yeah. And then this guy put up a yard sign when I had that. You just need to remind them, because everyone knows there's tons of government waste. Bill, you had a question.
Yes, tell us about Mitt Romney, and a follow-up question is, let's assume for a moment that the next president of the United States is Mitt Romney. Do you think there is any hope that he would push for, of course, the legislation has to be passed by Congress, but do you think there's any hope that he would work for serious cuts, really serious cuts in government spending, any hope whatsoever?
I would say no. I ran against Mitt Romney in 2002 for governor as a libertarian. And we posted a blog or a press release at lp.org, so if you go to the website and search on Mitt Romney, there's a couple pieces that we put up there. And he increased government spending on the books in the 4 years he was there by $3 billion. But what he doesn't tell you or remind you of is the fact that there's something called off-budget spending, which is a whole day's talk in and of itself. But it's a pervasive, huge problem in governments at all level in this country. And in Massachusetts, the budget, for instance, last year, where the official budget was about $30 billion, total government spending was over $50 billion. Almost double what they pretend that it is. So while Mitt Romney was governor, the legislature voted to take $2 billion on budget and put it off budget, meaning the actual increase in government spending under his 4 years as governor was $5 billion. Now, when he first ran for president in 2008, and I haven't been hearing it as much this year, he was continually bragging about how he cut government spending $2 billion or cut it $3 billion. And these lies are unbelievable, how the press will repeat them without any vetting, without any. They don't like to talk about off-budget spending. The media is very much an ally, if not an instigator, of this misinformation. I've had dozens of conversations with reporters and anchors and managers and others in the media, mainstream media, saying, why don't you guys expose this? And they just change the subject. They have no interest in exposing it. So, anyway, we could go on forever. But Mitt Romney increased government spending. He did not cut it. He increased it. He also increased dozens, if not scores, possibly over 100 different taxes, including gun fees. Wasn't that lovely? I think he increased them threefold from what they were. And his excuse was, well, a lot of these things hadn't been risen in a long time, and we're just sort of adjusting for inflation. He passed a law that enabled the local cities and towns to raise business property taxes, hostile to businesses. He proposed several taxes when he was running for governor that he just sort of mentioned, kind of threw out there. They got one article in the press and were forgotten about. All the while saying that he had taken a no new taxes pledge. All the while. And then he comes along with Romney Care. Now, what is so dangerous about Republicans, and this lesson was so clear in Massachusetts, I will assert to you they are more dangerous than Democrats.
I agree.
And the reason is because when a Democrat like Hillary Clinton comes along and proposes socialized medicine, she meets with huge resistance from Republicans. And that thing never went to vote. In 1988, Governor Michael Dukakis proposed another very similar Hillary Care, Romney Care, Obamacare kind of plan. It was passed into law.
And then under the subsequent governor, William Weld, it was repealed. Mitt Romney, or Barack Obama, comes along with Obamacare. Now it is passed, barely. They had to resort to reconciliation to do it. But it's been under fire. There's about 22 states where there's been ballot initiatives or legislation to thwart it. There's lawsuits all over the country to thwart it. We'll see what happens when it goes to the Supreme Court. It is met with huge resistance. And every Republican candidate is claiming they will repeal it, at least claiming. Now, let's look in contrast to what happened when Mitt Romney, Republican, came along and proposed Romneycare. The only Republican, well, there's been a few who've talked about it, actually, Schwarzenegger and some others. He's the only Republican, to my knowledge, who actually got a major socialized medicine plan passed into law. And what happened? What did the Republicans in Massachusetts do when he passed that law? They voted for it. They went, yes, sir, and voted for it. They won't shoot their own dog, no matter how bad it gets. And so if Mitt Romney were to become president, what you will find, though he's claiming he'll repeal Obamacare, what he will do is take off his blue jersey, put on a red jersey, call it Romneycare or something else, and the Republicans will vote for it. And the resistance, you will see the conversation start to disappear. All the Republicans we had Republicans in Massachusetts in the 90s going on and on about Hillary Care. Hillary, she's awful. She's terrible. Hillary Care is so bad. And then Romney comes along 2 years later, silence. Silence. There was not a single mainstream media column or news article that opposed it in any significant way. We were the only ones, and we generally are not welcome in the mainstream media, especially between campaigns. They have to cover us during the campaign. So this is why Mitt Romney and Republicans in general are, in my opinion, even more dangerous than the Democrats. Who's been waiting in the back here? Sorry, I think you were.
Yes, sir. Here's the basic premise for you. What do you do about the areas of government where they had their own funding areas, Medicare, Social Security, where it's basically entitlement, and people say, hey, I paid into it, I deserve back, and really the only way to get out of it basically is to stop the amount of payments. You have equal money, so you want to tell these people, hey, we're going to cut your benefits.
Harry Brown, how many know Harry Brown from this? Wasn't he incredible?
Mm-hmm.
His book, Why Government Doesn't Work, and his subsequent book, The Great Libertarian Offer, lays out his proposal for ending Social Security. And his plan was basically to sell off federal assets, of which there are tens of trillions, over some period of time, do some means testing, so you would take away Social Security from the very wealthy who don't need it and cut it off at a certain age, and basically liquidate these assets and give these accounts over to the people dependent on Social Security, not in some government scheme where the government controls it, but just, here's your lump sum, go invest it, you're on your own, don't blow it. You go to Vegas and gamble it away, there ain't going to be nobody to bail you out. You manage your retirement. And that was his basic plan, which also meant almost immediately ending the Social Security tax, which is the biggest tax for many workers today, much more so than the federal income tax. So it was a brilliant plan. Now, one of the things that I caution about that is today you have this dramatic inequity going on between the private and public sector. If you've taken a look at government sector pensions, their early retirement, the amount of money they put away, we've calculated that about $5 trillion has been put away nationwide for government pensions, and there's nothing in Social Security. And these people retire on average about 13 years younger, and they have defined benefits. So if the market goes down, too bad. They get the same amount, and it goes up automatically. I mean, the inequities, we could talk an hour about this, are unbelievable. And what I've seen some people doing, some of these government workers have noticed that, uh-oh, the well's drying up here. What are they doing? They're selling federal assets to fund federal pensions. Not Social Security, not Medicare for the everyday taxpayer, but they're grabbing those assets and liquidating them for government special interests. And that's a dangerous trend. So I'm almost afraid to suggest the idea of liquidating federal assets, even though we should, but there's a real danger of it going to the wrong place. And so I just say that with, I'm not really sure how to play that. But I think what I can say for now is before we even talk about cutting Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, let's talk about government pensions now. I mean, they've started to make a little bit of cuts, and if you look at it, typically the way it works in Massachusetts and a lot of states is new people coming into government, younger people, don't get a really good deal. It's the people who retired over the last 10, 15, 20 years, or who are now retiring or heading for retirement, that's sort of the golden year of government pensions. There's some people that are 90 now who didn't get in on it early enough, and their pensions aren't necessarily so great. And it varies a lot from agency to agency, so you can't just make one blanket statement. It's very complicated. The new people who come into government already are paying in much more than the people my age and older had to pay in. And they are not going to get as much. So you want to be careful when you talk about it, not to alienate the younger government workers who aren't getting the kind of deal. Now, some of them, if they survive the system, if we don't change it, it's hard to believe it won't explode long before 20, 30 years from now, they make it more attractive. There's sort of a hazing system. You know, if you can survive being a teacher or survive being a government bureaucrat, the benefits get better and better. And these are the people who are lined up for the largesse. And the others and the ones who just quit, burn out, and don't want to put up with it, they never even get a pension. So I think it's a matter of priorities. We have to make sure that if there's any talk of cutting the Social Security that you were forced to pay into, that should come after a talk of cutting government pensions. Make sense?
Yeah.
Do it, sir, yes. Hi.
So you got a lot of votes in three-way races. Do you have any data from your race? Independents then? Did you take votes who were going to Republicans, Democrats, anything like that?
I think it was independents, people that may have voted Republican, some that would have voted, because we were running against Ted Kennedy. I got 12%, the Republican got 13%, and Kennedy got 72%. So that 25% that's up for grabs, in a lot of races, goes to Republicans. But that doesn't even, in Massachusetts, we only had something like 12 or 13% registered Republicans, a lot of independents. So it probably were those independents that often vote Republican or that would vote for a third party if there was one there. They are not necessarily Republican loyalists. We did a fair amount of TV advertising, so we were reaching to a mass market of people in that independent, undecided, flippable category of voters in the middle. Yes?
It sounds a little bit on your application of tax cuts. And I apologize because I don't have an answer ready. But to me, to a certain extent, that seems like you're trying to kind of out-Republicanism in that aspect.
What Republican is cutting taxes?
It's a talking point, I guess. It's what it comes down to. And to me, that's, you know, it makes us very easy to define, to kind of, oh yeah, you know, there's that tax cut kind of thing. And what we don't, I think, have is kind of that golden thread argument sort of shifts the entire paradigm. Like, we're still playing in their sandbox when it's like, you know, okay, we're going to cut taxes X amount. Whereas if there was again, I apologize, I don't have the answer.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things I guess we're all working on. But you know, you're trying to break through the categorical imperative that people kind of have. We're a political party, they can pigeonhole us. I don't think that's, I think that's kind of limiting the appeal, whereas if we're going to have kind of an overriding, universal sort of, this is something entirely different.
Well, let me address that, because, like I say, this libertarian solution I'll be talking about a lot, and it's going to be different at local, state, and federal government. Very different. And it's very wide open. You can address a lot of different issues and a lot of different areas of government. The key is to cut one of them, to reduce, remove, dismantle. Now, in my view, that is not playing in a Republican sandbox at all. Their sandbox is maintaining and increasing government in every way possible. Yes, the rhetoric is often about tax cuts.
But aren't you kind of ending it right there when you're saying it's about the tax cuts? You're not even getting to that.
Oh, no, I'm not saying it's only about tax cuts at all. It can be about ending the war on medical marijuana. And your focus could be on ending the war on medical marijuana. Your focus can be on we need to stop the suffering of AIDS and cancer patients and people with migraines and glaucoma who are being harmed and deprived of these life-saving medicines and relief from their comfort and pain. And it can focus on that, and the tax cut part can be a small part of it. It'll be one more benefit out of 8 benefits. So you see what I'm saying? You don't have to focus
on it. I do. I got the impression that you were saying that's kind of the lead.
Yeah, no, I think it's I think government spending is the number one priority in terms of what we must accomplish. Because if we don't cut spending, they're going to keep doing what they're doing. We will never break the juggernaut till we start to really address cutting spending. And we can do that by going after the war on drugs. We can go after military spending, foreign intervention, military bases all over the world. That's a ton of money right there. We can go after areas of health care and education spending and HUD and all kinds of government bureaucracy. So I might have not made myself clear. It does not need to have the primary focus, but it should include that as an element to make sure we're always taking away their number one resource, which is money.
Okay.
Yes?
Would you discuss the Ron Paul phenomenon and how we can take advantage of it?
Ron Paul. Ron Paul, I think, has been a tremendous, tremendous opportunity for libertarians, for lovers of liberty. Now, I know he's not in our party, and he's chosen to run for the GOP. But he is very much libertarian. And he has, the phenomenon of Ron Paul is something I don't think any of us have seen in our lifetime in terms of getting our libertarian message out there, activating young voters and young activists, articulating why these things are good as a credible spokesperson. He's been very much carrying our water, carrying libertarian message. He's not carrying the message that the GOP is carrying. He's carrying a libertarian message. So my suggestion has been that we should be as kind and as welcoming and encouraging of him as we can be. And because we want to bring those supporters into the Libertarian Party. If Ron Paul does not win the GOP nomination, where are these people going to go? Do we want them resenting us because we were so partisan that we alienated him and his supporters? Or do we want them to go, well, now what am I going to do? Libertarian. I mean, a lot of them are looking at the Libertarian Party, and a lot of them are interested in what we're doing, and they see that we're the party that's offering what Ron Paul offers. We want to become the Libertarian Party. I do. I assume you do, too. And so I think we can be polite and encouraging. Doesn't mean we endorse Ron Paul. But we can be polite and encouraging and very positive in the way we speak about him. And I think this will serve the Libertarian Party very well. That's my recommendation. Any other questions?
Maybe. Seems to me that one of the biggest problems with government budgeting has to do with what is a virtual mandate that departments have to spend every penny of the budget that they have. Otherwise, they cannot even hope to get what they have the following year.
Right.
And this is like a built-in must. You must actually increase your budget. It seems to be almost built in. There has to be a way we can change that. It might take an act of Congress to change that.
Well, I don't know that they're mandated, or they have a lot of motivation with it. I mean, that's what they do.
They're essentially.
They are motivated within the department.
How many times is it about carrying over? You're not allowed to carry over.
But, you know, let's be honest. I've worked in corporations for years. Corporations do this too, right? You've got a department. Your budget's about it. People spend it, okay? It's human nature to do that. But the government employees and government agencies are particularly motivated.
Yes.
And unlike in the private sector, there's no one watching what they're doing.
There's no penalty either.
There's no penalty. If you look, I mean, in Massachusetts alone, there's 500 bureaucracies. Most people have no idea they exist, what their name, and they're not reported on. You know, sort of randomly, once in a while, you hear about one of them here and there. But is anybody looking at what the department of blah, 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 how much they spend, what they were chartered to do, whether they accomplished that, at what cost? How much are they wasting? Is anyone watching that? No. The only people watching it are the people in that department, and their number one priority is making sure the money stays there and goes up. So they're lobbying, they're spending it, they're justifying it, they're lobbying, lobbying, lobbying constantly for more money. They don't need any mandate to do that. They're doing that, from what I can tell, pretty much on their own. And the thing we, and there's not much we can do about that directly, but as libertarians we can run on shrinking government and selling our case for shrinking government. If these tax cut initiatives had passed, and I got so many comments from people in Massachusetts about how scared they were running. They were running scared of our initiative, because when we take their money away, things will get cut. It doesn't mean it won't get cut nearly like they said. And their pork will get cut, not the things that they threaten. But they were concerned. And that is the only way I know that we can really go after that in a big way. Sir?
Again, to address the issue of tax cuts, if we don't, at least at the federal level, link back the tens of deficit spending, then we're only increasing the problem.
Given that it's, what, $1.4 trillion in the red?
If we cut taxes and we don't put an end to deficit spending, then they will continue to borrow it.
And if they continue to borrow and print it, they are effectively taxing us anyway, right? We do. We do have to bring the budget in balance. I certainly agree with you. But we shouldn't stop there, you know. I would propose that we should be bold and keep driving the conversation and driving people's thinking beyond that. Because hey, when it was 1.9 under Clinton, it was way bloated, way overspending. Harry Brown in the 1990s proposed in one of his books cutting government spending down to $100 billion. And he made the case for how you could fund everything we need, including the military, and the military would be most of that budget, with $100 million. That's it. We could actually have a much better federal government, a lot more freedom, a lot less regulation, you know, thriving businesses, thriving job opportunities with a small federal government and still be perfectly safe. So we should keep driving that conversation. Anybody else? Sir.
How do we get around the fact that 90% of the people say they disapprove of Congress, they're doing a bad job, but 60% or more say their congressman is good?
Yeah, I mean, that's a problem, but, you know, I'd be interested. I haven't seen the numbers yet about the 60% in my district. Sometimes, and it depends on who are they polling, likely voters? Often these polls are likely voters. A lot of who we need to reach are those people who don't vote. And that's about 60% of the adult population that just typically don't show up. At local elections, it can be 80 and 90%. That is a huge constituency. And so a lot of our message when we're out campaigning is, are you registered? Will you vote? Not just, do you favor me over this other guy? And it is libertarian campaigns that can bring those people out. And I would suggest that there are very few congressmen, if you took the entire adult population eligible to vote, eligible to register to vote, that no one hit 60%. I'd be surprised if very many of them hit 30%. Most people want what libertarians offer. The problem is that most of the ones who want what we want aren't voting. So we need to reach out to them in every way that we possibly can and be constantly saying, you want change? Register to vote. Will you do it? Now, a lot of them, I run into people all the time, and you probably do too, who say, I want what you want. Yeah, and they're bad, they're terrible. You register to vote? Nah, don't do that. Will you register? Ah, it's hopeless. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, how many hear this?
All the time.
A lot, right? I have talked myself blue in the face to people trying to convince them to register to vote. And you know what? When you go on and you can't get anywhere with them, and this works, say to them, I know. It just really looks hopeless, doesn't it? And I'm out here working like a fool trying to change things. Will you do me a favor? Will you register to vote tomorrow for me? Would you? And you ask it as a personal favor. And you know what? I've watched people, they'll flip at that moment. They go, all right. And then they start, these emotions start to emerge, and they start talking about how much they hate the politicians and how much they should do this and they should do that. And it's like all of a sudden, something starts to tick inside them that maybe they want to actually get off their butts, and do something. Because we need those people to vote. Anybody else?
Yes, I'd like to follow up on what Lorenzo was talking about. And this is about messaging. And because you've run for office, I'll put it as a question to you. It seems to me that the people that really advance high into national office, especially at the presidential level, have a manner of speaking that relies on a technocratic jargon. Barack Obama did it, Bush didn't, but you know, Clinton certainly did. And I'm wondering,
I'm not sure what jargon you're talking about.
For example, Lorenzo pointed out the question about budgeting.
Yeah.
Should, for example, libertarians be making a kind of somewhat arcane point, but it gets down to specifics, that if they merely changed the COLAs and the escalators from a changed CPI instead of a normal CPI, we get $300 billion in savings. That's very getting down to the weeds. But it's the kind of...
Sorry, government pensions? Or?
Well, very many government programs are on escalators are on COLAs that are built on the CPI.
Yeah.
And so a very simple change that the vast majority of economists agree would be helpful. Doing to change CPI instead of the normal CPI, you pay $300 million. Now, my question in a political campaign is, do libertarians win by exposing and talking in that way, getting down into the weeds instead of these broad pronouncements, I'd like to get rid of all of the departments from energy, you know, education, these are grand promises, but...
Well, I think you hit on something that could be a really good libertarian solution or proposal, which would be just, but you have to put it in terms that ordinary voters think. CPI does not register. COLA is not even, a lot of people know what COLA is, but we need to translate everything into very everyday, Joe Sixpack, soccer mom terms. Easy to understand, simple terms. And the way I would phrase that is, you know, all these government agencies, they've set it up where they automatically increase. They get automatic increases. Now, does your company get automatic increases if your customers aren't buying as many products? If you're a contractor, if you mow lawns and you don't mow, and you mow the same amount of lawns as last year, do you automatically get more money this year? Well, if you don't, why should government? Is that right? Why I propose, as a libertarian candidate for state legislature, that we end all these automatic increases for government spending. They only get what they need, and we get rid of all of these automatic increases. If it's not fair for you, it's not fair for them.
Something like that.
Anybody else?
Were you included in televised debates?
Yes.
Oh, okay. On a national level, that's a big problem because they're controlled by the establishment.
And they're controlled at the state level very much. They played tremendous games with us. Tremendous. Excluded us, let us in. We went to court at one point over a debate I was invited to and then excluded from. And it's a battle that we always have to fight.
And if I may, I would say that it depends on the culture of the state. Harlan's fortunate to get in. In Virginia, I've been a statewide candidate twice. They don't allow minor party candidates into televised any debates, televised or not. Minor party candidates do not get into, and not just me, do not get into debates with major party candidates in Virginia. Period. It's just the culture of the state up to now. Hopefully we can change that.
Some states are better. In New Hampshire, they've often been let in. There's some states where you see them. You watch C-SPAN, and once in a while you see a libertarian on there in a governor debate, Senate debate. So I don't know what the deal is here in Maryland. Have you had
one?
Not good.
I participated in a debate one time because when I was campaigning, I found a leaflet announcing the debate, for which I'd never been invited.
On the sidewalk.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, and then they let me in, it's a big face. So.
How nice.
Very interesting. Very nice. Very
how did you raise $800,000 for your senatorial campaign?
Got to know. Oh, it's a secret. Okay, how did we raise 860-some? I don't remember the number. We raised a lot of money. And there were several factors. One was that Michael Cloud was our fundraiser. And he taught me a lot about fundraising. I did a lot of fundraising myself. I picked up the phone and called a lot of donors.
And we had a really good campaign going. We had the money to do some advertising. We had the momentum of the gun community behind us. So I was speaking to a lot of gun clubs and groups. And we got to the point where I would, if I could get away with it, I would spontaneously turn my speech into a fundraising pitch. And I would try to get, for instance, if I was at a gun club, I'd say, hey, would you suggest it for me? Because if the president of the club will say, hey, donate to her campaign, she's working for us, that goes a long way. And so that sometimes helped, and I'd raise a chunk of change right at an event spontaneously. But it was a lot of hard work. Fundraising is not easy. It's something that, Michael Cloud is a professional who's had decades of training in this, and he does it very well. One of the tricks to getting Michael Cloud to fundraise, he's fundraised for the Libertarian candidates, is you got to have a good campaign, a good candidate, and a hard-working candidate who's running on bold reductions in government. That's the kind of campaign he will help. And the other thing about that is those are also the campaigns that are the easiest to fundraise for. A lot of Libertarians have this idea that they have to water down our message somehow. We don't need to water it down. We need to sell it better.
Exactly.
Harry Brown had an extremely bold agenda as president, as our presidential nominee in 1996 and 2000, and the income tax, and the war on drugs. Pull troops home. Cut spending to $100 billion. End Social Security, completely privatize it. It doesn't get much bolder than that. And he was completely credible in the way he sold every one of those proposals. Absolutely brilliant. And if you haven't read his books, read them immediately. They're great. So bold campaigns, I bring that up because when you're fundraising, this is the stuff that gets people excited. You say, Mitt Romney, who knows what he's going to do. Let's try to pick something a little more concrete. Rick Santorum says he'll repeal Obamacare. What will you replace it with? And look for, get him on record, find what he said he'd replace. Almost all these guys would replace it with something almost as bad. And then say, I will not only repeal Obamacare, I'm going to get rid of all the government legislation at the federal level that I can that drives up the cost of health care. Like, let's start with the FDA. Or, the NIH has in it the NAS. If you look at the healthcare bureaucracies, there are hundreds of bureaucracies within bureaucracies within bureaucracies. It's insane how much money they're spending. So you can talk about cutting healthcare spending dramatically. So most people don't even need insurance, much less government subsidies. So you can start proposing things like this and take it bolder and sell it. Lay out why you are going to be better off if this happens. Now, healthcare is one of the harder ones to sell, I will tell you. It's very complicated. But ending the income tax, getting rid of the Department of Education, getting rid of, 20, 50, 100 federal agencies you could go after, it's pretty easy to come up with benefits and make it very attractive to voters. And when you do that, the people who support you, who are libertarians, they respond because they say, someone is finally saying what I think and saying it proudly, confidently, and selling it in a credible way. And that inspires people, and that's one of the keys to funding it. There's a lot more that I can say about it, but that's enough for now. Yes.
What about, do you have any pointers regarding selling the idea that we need to avoid catastrophe? I mean, in 2010, I spoke at a Tea Party event with a fellow by the name of James Bacon, wrote a book called Boomergeddon. This was written in 2010, as I recall. He predicts that by the year 2027, there will be no buyers for the debt of the United States government. That's about 15 years, I think, right? He predicts that by that time, no buyers for the debt of the United States government. I just read an address or a presentation, a transcript of a presentation given by Neil Ferguson, a well-known Harvard economist, who said that on the path we're going right now, by the year 2040, federal revenue will be enough to cover the interest on the debt, and that's it, which, of course, we'll never get to that.
Right.
Right now, perhaps the biggest thing is avoiding economic catastrophe. But that's not a very positive message.
No.
That may be the most important thing, though, right now.
Yep.
And what would you say regarding the message of selling sort of the negative unseen.
Yeah, I think you can. I think what the libertarian solutions that I recommend is you start with the bad news, and you know, and you can lay out some of those. Now, I think you have to pick terminology that's within their realm of understanding. Most people I talk to who are not particularly political, if you say to them, "Do you think our country is in trouble?" They say,
"Yes."
They say, "Yes." We all know that that people understand them. You don't need to say much more than that because that's about as much as they can articulate it in a lot of cases. We have too much debt, government spending too much, and we can't buy as much with our dollar. Our dollar is getting less and less valuable, and there is a risk of hyperinflation. Most people understand that that's a possibility. Now, if you get any more detail than that, or you try to cite some economists they haven't heard of, you've lost them. But you speak in some of the basic terms that just ask the people around you in your life what they understand. Get them, ask them, see what they see, what their level of understanding is, and then use that as your guide in laying out, we got to do something. Then you've got to come up with a solution that does have benefits. And that might mean you have to cut taxes. I understand, we got to cut debt too. But you might also be able to couch it as, if we don't, you could also sell it possibly as, we got to eliminate the deficit for starters, because if we don't, that $5 loaf of bread is going to be $7, and then it's going to be $10. But your income isn't going to double in the time that it goes from $5 to $10. What are you going to do? We need to do something. We need to do something. So you can, I think, these days, you couldn't do it 5 years ago, but these days I think you can sell people, but you have to show how it affects them. If not, providing a direct benefit, avoiding terrible pain, like their dollar doesn't buy anything. And people can understand that because they see it when they go to the grocery store. That's what I would say. I mean, we could talk more about it, but I think that's the beginning. Okay, I think we're all done. Thank you very much.
Let's take a little break, and then we will have the representatives from our presidential candidates.